Welcome to the Connected Insurance Podcast, presented by Agency Revolution. Listen to interviews with the most influential people in the insurance industry. Learn the most important strategies, tactics, trends, and challenges facing today's independent insurance agents and brokers. New episodes every Wednesday. Visit agencyrevolution.com and click media to explore the Connected Insurance family of resources for insurance agents and brokers. Subscribe today and get updates delivered right to your inbox. And now, without further delay, the Connected Insurance Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is Michael Janz, co-founder of Agency Revolution, and I want to welcome you to this episode of the Connected Insurance Podcast, presented by Agency Revolution, creators of Fuse, the insurance marketing software that skyrockets retention, boosts policy per customer, and makes your clients love your agency. Without you having to hire more staff, programmers, or technologists, visit agencyrevolution.com. Get a demo. You'll be glad that you did. I'm thrilled to introduce you to this conversation. I suppose I have many shortcomings as your podcast host, among them interrupting my very patient guests, and two, from time to time being effusively enthusiastic about my guest, and this time I will willingly commit that second sin. I am effusive about this conversation with Dennis Chookasian. I normally don't read an entire bio, and I may not get through this entire bio, but you got to hear some of this. Dennis, by his own admission, has had basically four careers, and each one of which I think you or I would say, wow, well done. So let me share a few things about Dennis Chookasian. Dennis is the retired chairman and chief executive officer of CNA Insurance Companies. He served as CNA's chairman and chief executive officer from 1992 until 1999. He also served as chairman of the executive committee of CNA from 1999 to 2001. From 1990 to 92, Mr. Chookasian served as CNA's president and chief operating officer. For all PNC life, health, and investment operations, he joined CNA in 75, served as CFO until 1990 when he was named president. He served as chairman and CEO of Empower Inc., an internet financial advisory service from 99 to 2001. Prior to joining CNA, he was a management consultant with Deloitte for 8 years, working on various financial and systems-related assignments. Dennis served as chairman of the FASAC, Financial Accounting Standards Advisory Council, which provides guidance to the Financial Accounting Standards Board. On accounting matters for 5 years, completed his term in 2012. He was also a member of the Financial Crisis Advisory Group, which was the international commission that was created to develop recommendations to solve financial reporting problems associated with the financial crisis of 2008. During his career, he served as director on the boards of 13 publicly traded corporations, 50 private corporations. He's currently a director of 4 public companies, including the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the world's largest financial futures and derivatives exchange, Career Education, a private post-secondary education provider, Maxar Technologies, a space satellite technology company, and Pillarstone Capital, a real estate investment trust. He is an adjunct professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, teaches course in corporate governance. He teaches a course in international corporate governance in China at the Shanghai Advanced Institute of Finance in China. He's a trustee of the Northwestern University, a member of the advisory board of the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, a member of the advisory board of Kellogg Graduate School of Management. He's also a member of the National Board of Boy Scouts of America, director of the Northwestern Memorial Foundation, and president of the Foundation for Health Enhancement. He earned a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from Northwestern University, an MBA from the University of Chicago Booth Graduate School of Business, and a Master of Science degree in economics from the Lennon School of Economics. He's a certified public accountant, a chartered global management accountant, chartered public casualty underwriter, and a certified management consultant, as well as a member of the director's table of Beta Gamma Sigma, an honorary fraternity. In 2010, Mr. Chookasian received the Outstanding Director Award from the Financial Times Outstanding Directors Exchange. Quite the resume, also quite the conversation. We do cover, as you can imagine, we cover kind of that high level. What are the trends and forces that are affecting the industry? But Dennis has a really practical orientation. Remember that he was the CEO and chairman of a major national insurance carrier and relied on the independent agent distribution system for the success of that company. So he's well-grounded, got his feet on the ground, and we do quickly turn this into a very practical conversation about success. I think there are a number of surprises in this conversation, and I will say, to complete this introduction, I had mentioned to a colleague of mine that I just interviewed Dennis Jukasian, and he said, well, you're about to learn more about insurance than you ever did. And in fact, I can say that after about an hour in this conversation with Dennis, there's a lot. After 25 years in the industry, I tend to think I know a thing or two. I learn a lot in this conversation, and I am certain you will too. Please enjoy this conversation with Dennis Jukasian. Dennis, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
Good, thank you. Good to talk to you, Michael.
Well, I'm really excited about this conversation. The last time you and I had a conversation, I took notes. So be aware that when Dennis Jukasian talks, Michael Janz takes notes. And when I was done, I thought, wow. This is stuff that people need to hear. You have insights that are quite profound, and you know things that I don't know, which is not a very high bar. And so thank you so much for offering to be a guest on our podcast series. So if I can, let's start with perhaps a little thumbnail biography of Dennis.
Sure. I'm native Chicagoan, born and raised here, and I have my educational background, did a chemical engineering degree at Northwestern, MBA at the University of Chicago, master's in economics from London School of Economics, and basically I've had three careers. I was with Deloitte doing consulting work for 8 years, about half of it financial, half of it technical systems. Then I was with CNA, the insurance company, for 27 years. I was CFO and CIO for 15 years, and I was president, chairman, CEO for 9 years, and then served on the board for about 3 years after I retired. And I'm now in career three. And in career three, I do basically two things. I serve on the boards of a number of companies, and a number of them are in the insurance industry and some outside of the industry. And then I also teach two courses at the University of Chicago in the business school and at Booth on corporate governance, and I also teach at two universities in China.
Got it.
Quick thumbnail.
All right. So with that background, definitely want to dive into your brain. And Dennis, I think you have I won't say unique, but a rare perspective, a high-level perspective on what's happening in the industry. You've been in it a long time. You've held very, very top leadership positions in the industry. And now you kind of have this opportunity to look at it with a little bit of distance. And I know, as you've told me, you write about it with some frequency and you share your insights fairly broadly. I'm going to start with a sort of very big question. And there are a few things that we will drill down to. But one is, you know, my first question is, you know, the context, this feels like a very different industry than it did, not just, you know, in 1995, really not just different than 2005, but it feels different now. And it seems that we are perhaps at a tipping point of change, and there are trends and strategies that people should be aware of. So big question, what's happening in the insurance industry right now, property and casualty?
Sure. And I would agree with your statement that it does feel very different. And I'm reminded of the old saying that says that it's not a destination, it's a journey. And I think that really applies to the insurance industry. I've been involved in the industry since the 60s, so it's over 50 years now, and I've seen tremendous changes in that period of time. And I guess if I were to pick the one biggest change, and it's continuing today, and it's been a continuum, not just in one day, has been the shift in the nature of control of the insurance process itself and where the profitability of the industry goes. If you go back 50 years ago, if you were to say, if you took 100 cents on the dollar of an insurance profit,
right,
where did it end up? And I'll be real rough with the numbers because there's no exact number for this, but something like 60% or so of the profit of an insurance transaction would have ended up in the underwriter's hands, the person who had the underwriting capability. Maybe 30% or so would have ended up in the distribution, and maybe 5 or 10% in service or service-related activities.
Mm-hmm.
If you fast forward to today, that balance has shifted tremendously, and it shifted so that today I would speculate that more like half to two-thirds of the profit ends up in the hands of distribution, and a smaller number, maybe 40 to 50% of distribution, maybe 40 to 50% gets into the underwriter's hands, and maybe up from 5 or 10 to maybe 10 to 20% in services.
Can I interrupt for just a second? Because just for clarification, can you explain what that third category is? The services.
Sure. Third category would be people who provide actuarial services, computer system support, outsourcing of claims.
Got it.
All of those kinds of things that help the company do its job. Now, what is the reason that drove that shift?
I think if you asked the average principal of an independent insurance agency, they wouldn't have known that. They wouldn't say, gosh, we're getting the lion's share of profit now.
Yeah, and what has shifted is control and power for the following reason. Back 50 or 60 years ago, and this is the case in any industry, you have to look at your core competency. And your core competencies that are the critical factors in an industry determine who gets the profitability and who controls. So if you go back 50 years ago, there were two key core competencies if you were going to do insurance. One was capital, and the second was information.
Okay.
You had to have a significant amount of capital, and it was hard to come by, and it was expensive. And second, you had to have information, also hard to come by, very expensive to get. And so who had the capital and the information? It was the carriers.
Carriers.
So since the carriers had and controlled the key core competencies, they were able to garner more of the profit, more of the control. Fast forward to today, the one thing we all know, of course, is that capital is very easy to get and very low cost. Not a big deal. Information is really readily available today and becoming more and more available.
And so, yeah, okay. And I'm going to put a finger in that one. We'll circle back to that because I think that's a fascinating transition. Okay.
Right. So, and then the third thing, which is really the issue that drives everything today, is control of the customer.
Now, the control
of the customer, of course, means that everything shifts more toward distribution and away from the underwriter. And then in addition, the carriers, by and large, and the agencies have recognized they can't do it all themselves, so you don't build your own computer systems. You buy one. Whether if you're an agent, you'll buy from one of the two dominant ones, but there are others out there as well. If you are a, that are actually very effective, are a carrier, you'll use a lot of purchase software. And then when you get outside that, many people outsource claims. There are many virtual companies out there. And then, of course, the rise of the Internet causes a lot of change. And the rise of the lead aggregators has been a very substantial change. So having said all of that, that's given you the rise of services, which are bigger today.
Right.
And people don't feel they have to do everything themselves. You see the shift away from information and capital as the dominant competency toward control of the customer, and that all pushes things in the direction of distribution.
Question. Is this shift where the power is shifting away from the carrier to some extent, is that precipitating or causing the increased or accelerated consolidation of carriers?
Well, yes, I'd say that several things have happened.
Okay.
In the industry, and you have to separate the carrier side from the agency side.
Uh-huh.
And we're focusing here, of course, more on the independent agency system when we talk about that, because when you get into the direct writers, they have, of course, their own internal distribution.
Right.
But if you look at the carrier side, the big trend, again, over this long period of time, is the shift in the composition of the company. If you go back to 1980, the top 20 carriers, life, health, casualty, wrote a very significant proportion of all the insurance, maybe half or so. It's very, very big. Even though there's something like 3,000 licensed casualty companies and 2,000 licensed life and health companies, uh-huh. and it maybe consolidates down to 800 or 1,000 groups because most companies have more than one regulated entity that they have. But when you look at that, the top 20 back in 1980, of those top 20, 11 of the top 20 were pure multi-line, meaning that in 1980, the 11 of the top 20 wrote at least 10% in life, 10% in health, and 10% in casualty.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's
they
changed.
They were true multi-lines, and they had different proportions. Some were more life, some were more casualty, but they were all multi-line. Not all, but 11 of the top 20 were multi-line, so a significant amount. By the time you got to 1995, because of the relentless drive for what was called shareholder value and the view that investors had in the early 90s that monoline companies were more valuable, most of the major companies shed their multi-line operations. And so by the time you got to 1995 and 96, when I was the CEO of CNA, we were the last remaining multi-line. At that time, everyone had spun off the other operations. Aetna, which used to be the, I would argue, one of the most dominant casualty companies in 1980, by the time you got to the mid-90s, it was no longer in casualty or life, and it was a health company.
Right.
It was a complete shift, and that was what happened throughout the industry. So you went from having more than half, you know, 11 out of 20, being multi-line to only one, and then shortly after I retired from CNA, CNA sold off a lot of its operations, and it's no longer a multi-line either. It's now a casualty organization. So that's one really big shift. Second shift is the consolidation that's taken place. And so if you go back in the 60s and 70s, there was some acquisition of larger companies, but then for about 20 years, between roughly 1975 and 1995, there were no significant acquisitions or mergers within the insurance industry. There were a few foreign companies, such as the purchase of Fireman's Fund by Munich. You had things such as Xerox buying Crum & Forster, but there were no carrier-carrier mergers of
size. What period was this?
Roughly 75 to 95. You went through a 20-year period where it was more valuable for a foreign company, like somebody like Munich or Allianz or somebody like that, to acquire. And because of a combination of issues associated with this, also with taxation and with regard to currency, there really weren't seeing that because they could pay a little higher price to the extent that they were done. And then the industrial ones, Xerox being probably the last consolidation of that type, didn't work very well, and so that sort of stopped. So there were no mergers.
Mm-hmm.
When, in 1995, at CNA, we made a tender for and offered to acquire Continental, and we did acquire Continental in 95, and that was the first major insurance merger. Now, following that, a whole rash of mergers took place. Crum & Forster, USF&G, started looking at all of these mergers. So the industry did consolidate quite a bit on the carrier side. And you also saw the change in life companies, many of them moving from mutuals into stock company structures and becoming investor-owned, big change there. So a lot of change, and some demutualizations, as they occurred, also were occurring in the casualty side, more on the life side, but certainly occurring there as well. So there was a shift in a consolidation and change in the casualty side. Now, there was an even bigger change in the agency side. On the agency side, when you go back to 1980 or so, 1990 even, you had basically three tiers. You had what were called the alphabet houses,
right.
AFA, M&M, and the J&H, you know, all of these large brokerage firms who were largely property and casualty. They had life and health generally, but mm-hmm. largely property and casualty. And they wrote virtually all of the Fortune 500 insurance, which right. would be written through them. And there were maybe, depending on how you wanted to count, there were at least 10, maybe 20 that would call themselves large firms of that nature. Then there was everybody else, with a few consolidations and a few groups that were larger, but fundamentally it was the alphabet houses, and then another, maybe there were 35 or 40,000 licensed agencies at that time,
right.
of which maybe 20,000 real ones, because it's a number of just small licenses, and you know maybe 10 to 15,000 really substantial agencies,
uh-huh.
something like that.
Okay.
But there were, you know, 10 to 20 really big ones. They wrote all of the big insurance. Now, fast forward, what happened is you saw the rise of a new tier. The new tier were the roll-ups. Started with companies such as AVI, USI, Alliant Resources. These were companies that were formed with the idea of rolling up independent agencies. And then in the meantime, the two largest firms, Aon and Marsh, started acquiring right. lots of other firms as well. And so all of the alphabet houses got basically rolled up into two, or maybe you could argue that Willis and Gallagher are up there in that sort of general tier, but mm-hmm. somewhere between two and four. Aon and Marsh are bigger than the others, but nevertheless, you know, the others are they're material. And so you got a consolidation down to fundamentally two to four alphabet houses,
right.
and then you saw the rise of perhaps 20 or so consolidators, mm-hmm. people like uh-huh. the ones that I had mentioned, and then more recently things like Alera, for example, the Country Seguro. So there were a number like that.
Acrisure.
Yeah. Acrisure is
okay.
another one,
mm-hmm.
absolutely. The Brown & Brown
right.
one, Assured. You know, so there are a number like that, and they were basically rolling up. So today you actually have a three-tier market where it used to be a two-tier.
Okay, fair enough.
In the two-tier, it was essentially the large, maybe 10 to 20 really large firms and everybody else. Now it's maybe two to four of the large, and then maybe 10 to 20 roll-ups, and then everybody else. And so it's now basically a three-tier market, and that's changed the structure a great deal. So very substantial change has taken place, and those changes are continuing.
Okay, so I need to ask two or three questions, okay, because you're giving me a lot to work with, Dennis. First question, the consolidation at the carrier level, which started in 1995, and so we rolled on with that for a while. Impact on the independent insurance agent today, what do you think that is?
There was an impact, but I don't think the impact was all that material.
Okay.
The typical independent agent has maybe, depending on the size of the agency, they have at least five or six carriers, and they may have 20 carriers
mm-hmm.
because they have a lot of specialty requirements. But they'll tend to concentrate their volume with a few carriers,
fair
a
enough.
Small number.
Right.
Most
right.
of the carriers have a high performance program where they're expecting to get something like 30 to 40% mm-hmm. of the volume from the agency, and if the agent gives them that volume, they get special mm-hmm. treatment, special services, maybe special commissions. And so for that reason, they tend to have maybe three or four go to.
Okay. So now, so if we roll that trend out, I think you said that trend will continue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, does that become something that agents have to pay attention to?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I believe that while there'll be further consolidation, there's still so many carriers out there, and they attempt to be competitive with
right.
their products, that I think the agent, and because the agent has the control over the customer, the agent is critical to the independent agency carriers. And
yeah.
so they have to do their best to woo them to make sure that they understand why that agent should place his business with, you know, with your company versus the next.
We will get back to the control of the customer issue because, yes, I agree. That's ultimately that's where the rubber hits the road. So my next question is, do you think that there was an impact, or what was the impact, if any, of the separation of property and casualty from life and health at the carrier level. Did that affect the retail agent?
It did have an impact on them, and it also had an impact on the carriers.
Uh-huh.
Now, the push for that was driven largely by the so-called shareholder value,
right,
where people felt you could drive a higher share price by being a monoline entity. The reality of it is that when you were both life, health, casualty, you tended to have some offsets so that if one line wasn't doing so well, the other one maybe held you up a little bit.
Fair enough.
So it gave you more diversification.
Yeah.
So from a carrier point of view, if anything, I believe the carrier results are more volatile as a result of that change.
Oh, interesting. Okay, got it.
Now,
at the distribution level, and here's what I'm asking. I think traditionally, this has always been, you know, a little bit of a burr under my saddle that the typical independent insurance agency, most are really not that proficient at delivering and protecting their customers with non-PNC products like life, right, and often health. And I wondered, but I do remember the day where, you know, if you represented a certain carrier, you know, they were your PNC carrier, you still had to sell a half a dozen life policies in order to get on the cruise at the end of the year.
Yes, that's right.
So at least, you know, somebody was going to sell their six life policies or whatever it was. And now it's like, oh, nobody cares anymore. So I wonder if we've even stepped farther back from full protection for customers.
Yes. Well, I think that you said a whole series of things that I think are very profound. Number one, that
not likely, but go on. but I will write that down and quote you on it. So keep going.
You can quote me on that. But one of the point you made about the knowledge and the sale of the product, what we always found at CNA, and I think most carriers found the same thing, is that if you were running a successful property casualty agency and you were, let's say, a middle or a smaller agency, if you did that very well, it was going to be very hard for you to run a successful life or benefits business on top of it because the skills are different.
Indeed.
So you'd have to go and hire some people. You could build a department, and if you got the right people, it might be okay. But there were most of the agents weren't all that effective, and they tended to be concentrated in one area or another. In addition, the independent agency carriers generally would be found to be something like 80% commercial, 20% personal line.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course that 80 and 20 together, that 100% could be coupled with some life and health book. But the interesting thing is the reason for that is the independent agency share of the commercial insurance business is something like 60 or 70%
indeed,
today.
Right.
And it was that basically 50 years ago. 50 years ago, the independent agency system had more than 50% of the personal lines. And today, if you pull the regional carriers out, it's probably in the 10 to 15% range. And the independent agency carriers have lost that business largely because they're not price competitive. The combination of the distribution costs, which are so expensive in personal lines,
right,
driven people to go to the direct writers and to the online providers.
It seems to be a pretty fair analysis that the delivery of a personalized policy is going to be cheaper through the direct channel because it's a fairly efficient channel, right?
It is. It's an efficient channel, and it tends to be a good way to do it. And even the independent agency companies are using forms of internet distribution and so forth to get those people, and they'll provide leads to their agents, and agents will buy leads themselves. So that is the online sourcing of clients is very important. So the independent agent system, as a general statement, has gravitated toward the commercial insurance market. Now, having said that, there are some agents which are very heavily concentrated in personal lines, and they're very good at it.
Yeah.
They do it as an independent agency company.
Right.
If you go and look at the nationwide agents, for example, the nationwide agents, which were largely captive, their books are mostly personal lines,
exactly,
relatively little commercial.
Right.
So you have every form out there that you could imagine, but the one big trend that is absolutely the case is the independent agency system has gone from more or less half the personal lines market to something like 10 or 15%.
Okay. So I want to circle back to something else that you said, that the distribution of the profit dollar has been moving steadily towards the distributor and away from the carrier.
Right.
And yet I think that it would be safe to say that my average client doesn't know that, or, you know, the listeners to this podcast, gosh, they're probably not, you know, sort of celebrating in that, because it maybe doesn't feel that way. So I get why, but what do you think the impact is of that on the, on the distribution system?
Sure, yeah. And actually, I'd kind of make the argument that for our listeners who are in the distribution side and own an agency, mm-hmm. they all know that.
Okay.
And here is the reason why they know that. They may not be thinking of it in this way, but they know that.
Yeah.
And here's the reason. The reason is that if you go and look at the worth of a property casualty agency, if you go back 20 or 25 years ago, that agency would run, a well-run agency would run EBITDA margins of 15 to 20%, maybe getting a little higher, but in the 15 to 20% range. With the combination of the rising prices and what happened, that EBITDA margin is now in excess of 30% for a well-run agency. So they become much more profitable as a percentage of their commission than they were.
Okay.
Now,
yeah.
What that's driven, interestingly, is that if you go back to this period back 20 years ago or 15, 20, 30 years ago, when you went to sell an agency, there were times when you could buy an agency for one times commission or maybe even 0.5 times commission.
Yeah.
Today, well-run agencies sell for two times commission.
Uh-huh.
And the range is maybe 1.5 to as much as 3 or 4 times for certain ones.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are an agency principal, you know that you're more profitable because your margin has gone up from, you know, the high teens to, say, the low 30s. It's almost doubled.
Right, and the valuation.
The value of your agency has gone up. It's more than doubled.
Got it. Okay.
So everyone knows that.
But they may not be appreciating it every single day, but you're right. The margins have definitely gone in the right direction for the distributor. So I want to get feet on the ground here for a moment. So if you are running an independent insurance agency today and you're kind of looking at these broad sweeping changes, What strategic advice would you give to the owner of an agency today?
Well, I think it entirely comes down to this issue of control of the customer. And I think that if you're running an agency today, what you have to recognize is that the customer has a lot more options and more information than they've ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to build your distribution internally around specialty skill sets. So more specifically, if I were running sort of a broad-based, larger agency today, I would want to first look at the distribution, personal and commercial, look at how that's working. If I had the ability to hire the right kind of people for life and health, I'd want to build a life and health department because it can be very profitable if trying to cross-sell. Another thing I would do is I'd want to really closely look at my personal lines operation, because while the typical broker who's in the independent agency side is more focused on commercial, if you have a well-run personal lines operation
Indeed.
And you can do a little cross-sell, that can be very profitable.
Right.
But you need specialists. You can't just put someone who's untrained in there that's a younger person and say, go to it and answer the phone. You have to learn to market, and you have to learn how to use the lead aggregators and other internet sources for your leads.
Uh-huh.
And then the core competency, or what makes these agencies successful, is not a lot different than it was 20 or 30 years ago. It's that successful commercial lines broker who has great control over his clients. And so it's figuring out the right compensation system to incent that person to work for you rather than going across the street and working for your competitor.
Ah, okay. So the producer management system is a critical part of the equation on the commercial line side. Okay. So I want to throw in one other, you know, kind of big trend into this mix that you just shared, which is the impact of technology, not just at the carrier level, but also at the agency level. It would seem that clearly, you know, since 1995, there are a lot of technologies, not just emerging technologies. The internet is kind of, you know, is no longer like a brand new shiny new technology. But it would seem that today, the independent agency principal has a fairly serious responsibility to be aware of technologies, to be testing and experimenting technologies, and looking for ways that they can, one, produce efficiencies, but two, multiply their effectiveness.
Yes, that's right. And I think that it's a different story at the company level and at the agency level.
Right.
But at the
different
agency level.
Different set of technologies, but...
Yeah, different set of technology and different intent. At the agency level, again, it's all really oriented towards the CRM systems, you know, customer resource managers that are intended to give you better control over your potential customers, your prospects.
Exactly.
And then also your existing client set, and then learning how to use that technology to mine the internet source of leads, which is very important.
Indeed. Okay. So it seems to me that I want your thoughts on this, that of everything that we're talking about, there's nothing at the core as much as control of the customer.
I'd say that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. And so, and I know you worked for Deloitte. Now, so this is from a different advisory, name unnamed, but there was a report they came out with not too long ago that basically said, be ruthless with the broker that, you know, potentially damages your profitability. Take control of the customer. And so do you think there's, you know, like there's some anxiety that maybe the agency force isn't all that great at customer control?
Yeah. That statement, I would say, is I've got a name for that. I call it "sounds good when you say it fast."
Okay.
This is like the old Mark Twain. You know, the rumors of my demise were exaggerated.
Right.
The interesting thing about it is that I can remember when I started in the industry, and this literally is 50 years ago. Everybody was telling me that the independent agent was doomed and they were going to go away.
Okay.
And it was pretty clear that on the personal line side, that was probably accurate because you could see the cost differential.
Right.
Differential, just to put it in perspective, I'll give you rough numbers, but this explains the whole thing.
Yeah. Okay.
If you look at the cost of distribution for an independent agency company, that as a percentage of their premium, it's 30%, more or less. And it varies. 30%. If you look at Allstate and State Farm, they're around 19 to 21%, quite a bit better.
Wow. Yeah.
If you look at Geico's around 15, 16%. If you look at USAA, they're like 13 or 14%.
So
if you look at that distribution cost, if you can save at least 10% and maybe 15% going away from independent agent to someone else, then that business is going to move, and that's what's happened.
Got it. Okay. Now that's distribution. Now, so the balance then, I mean, that frees up the opportunity for a tremendous amount of advertising.
Yes, it does.
Direct side. Okay.
Yeah, it does. And so if you look at who are the largest purchasers of leads today, it is the direct writers, you know, Geico, Progressive. Who does the most advertising? I'm sure that every one of your listeners knows what a gecko is. And so, you know,
everyone in America knows what a gecko is.
That's right, yeah. And so,
in fact, everybody in Canada does because I've done a lot of business there, but they don't sell geckos up there.
Right, exactly. So everyone understands those icons.
Yeah.
If you go back 20 years ago, everyone knew that Snoopy was on a blimp. And they understood, you know, that.
Right. And there was the Pink Panther once, too.
That's right, yeah.
All right.
And so today, as you look at what's occurred, while there are these very broad advertising pushes that can take place, and that's really all oriented toward the personal lines customer.
Right.
And the commercial lines customer, because the control is still in the hands of the independent agent, the carriers don't do a great deal of advertising for commercial insurance because they know that it's under the control of that broker. It's
70% of the market mm-hmm. is there, and they know what they have to do instead of spending their money advertising to the end consumer.
Right.
They're better off in managing their agency plan and doing a lot of good things for the agency plan.
Got it. All right. Dennis, I have one more question for you. Do you have time for this one?
I certainly do.
Because I know you're an expert. Talk to us a little bit about blockchain, what you think the potential impact will be on the insurance industry. And before anybody like turns off their, the podcast, I want to encourage them to pay attention to this one.
Sure. I will. I've actually been working on blockchain and cryptocurrencies for about 5 or 6 years uh-huh. now. I'm on the board of the CME, and the CME has a futures contract on Bitcoin, and I've been pretty involved in following this whole industry and working on it, and I teach a class on it, actually. So I'll try to give you a quick breakdown. If you look at, because it's talked about widely in the press, you have to separate the cryptocurrency piece from the blockchain. The blockchain is the underlying technology under cryptocurrencies.
Right,
and
right.
Over time, there will be an evolution of cryptocurrencies, and there is a role for different forms of cryptocurrencies out there. It's not a big part of the overall market. Today, it represents about $140 billion in cryptocurrencies across roughly 2,000 currencies that are out there,
mm-hmm.
but that's contrasted with a $20 trillion economy in the U.S. alone, so it's not a big number. So it's not that important from the long-term point of view. But what is important is blockchain, because the blockchain provides a technology that allows you to do some things a lot better than they're currently done. So if you look at the impact over the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, an awful lot of our processes will be moved into the blockchain. Now, the blockchain is very easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
The blockchain is a network of computers around the world that fundamentally confirm the data, so you can't hack into them because you don't know where they are. And they're constantly talking to each other, and by talking to each other, they confirm that that data is always valid. So you know that you can't hack into it. So you've all read about blockchain fraud or cryptocurrency fraud. How did that happen?
Yeah.
Well, there's a very simple analogy. It's like a garden hose. If you use your garden hose and you hook it up to the wall and you've got a nozzle at the other end, when it leaks, it never leaks in the hose. It leaks at each end. And that's the problem that you have with the blockchain, because the blockchain itself is very secure, but it has to go through nodes where it converts back out into the real economy, and that's where all the fraud has occurred. So over time, what will happen as these get more secure and as the nodes get more secure, there are certain things that will become blockchain applications. So what will happen? Here's an example. Title insurance. When you go to buy a house, you have to get title insurance.
Right.
And the reason for that is the title plant's privately owned by Chicago Title or Stewart Title or someone like that.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, that should be a blockchain record that is controlled by local governmental units, so they know who owns every property and they know the full history of that property. Over time, that's what will happen. A second example is smart contracts. When you get a contract today, you get a piece of paper, or it might be electronic, but over time, it would be a lot better if those contracts were in a blockchain environment where it was permanent, it couldn't be changed, you knew you had some control over it. And so insurance contracts over time, I believe, will convert into blockchain structures.
How do you think this will make life different for the independent agency?
Well, it will make some things a lot easier. So some things, for example, like proof of insurance, mm-hmm. Most people have a POI system of some form, so the agent can provide to their client a proof they have insurance.
Right.
Well, that could all be done in blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you had a blockchain insurance contract and the person had access to it, they could do it all automatically in a secure method. They could allow access to certain people who want to see it. So that's a very simple thing. But payments will be more effective in blockchain as well than they are in the current system under credit cards, which is also the reason why the credit card companies are investing in their own blockchain solutions.
Right.
So over time, anything that has one of the sets of characteristics is likely to gravitate toward the characteristic toward the blockchain. One is it's got to be immutable, permanent, and can't ever be changed. Second is it needs to be held highly confidential and in a manner that can't be hacked. And third is you have the ability to control the identity so it can be completely anonymous as to how that transaction is taking place. So, and fourth is the speed of execution. So if you look to things which have a rapid speed of execution need, like credit card processing, it would be a lot better if you could have a high-speed blockchain network.
One last question, and the answer has to be short by definition. Given all that you've shared with us so far, Dennis, if you were going to just leave the independent insurance agency principal of today with some words of wisdom about how to really thrive over the next 2 or 3 years, what would you say?
I'd say, first, try to find someone that you can bring into your agency that really understands technology and the impact that technology can have on your agency to improve your operations and your marketing support. And second, I would say that I believe that the future of being able to cross-sell across life and health for a property casualty agency really has some growth potential because some of the challenges that have taken place in the life and health space in the past. And I believe an agency can do well by building a broader distribution system. So I would do those two things.
Got it. All right. Dennis, I know that you're not like, you know, looking for Twitter followers, but if somebody wanted to just had a need to find out more about what you're up to or somehow keep in touch with you, how do you encourage people to do that?
I'm on LinkedIn.
Okay.
And people can find me via LinkedIn, and I'd be happy to make connection if they do that.
And I will make sure that the spelling of your last name is in the show notes.
Okay.
All right. Dennis, well, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you and to share this time with you. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Well, thank you, and it was good talking to you.
Indeed.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Insurance Podcast. If you found this episode informative, please share it with your peers and colleagues. Explore the Connected Insurance family of resources for insurance agents and brokers by visiting agencyrevolution.com and clicking Media. Subscribe and get updates delivered right to your inbox. New episodes every Wednesday.